And we're back, and this is the Taylor Report, CIUT. Well, with us is Larry Krotz, whose book is Trapped by Tourism, Sustainability Questions for a World Fueled by Travelers. I should just say Larry Krotz is a journalist, documentary filmmaker, and author of more than a dozen books on topical issues. How I envy him. He was a Manitoba correspondent for the Globe and Mail, turning out almost 100 columns for the Saturday edition of the newspaper. His books include Indian Country, Inside Another Canada, Tourists, How Fast Our Fastest Growing Industry is Changing the World, Piecing the Puzzle, and Nothing Ordinary. Krotz resides in Toronto. Hey, Larry, good to see you.
Good to be here. Thanks.
That's a nice list of books. Well, here we are. This thing about tourists, but there's a second word, travelers. I know that you make a distinction. How did tourism become this, we use the word industry, a tourist industry? when did this begin?
Well, it's a very recent phenomenon to call tourism an industry. There have been travelers, you know, back to the beginning of time. But to refer to the industry of tourism is probably a function of the last quarter century, with a number of influences on it. To help with the explanation, let me go back and talk a little bit about the genesis of this
yes,
book.
Yes, please.
Because that'll shed some light on it. In March of 2020, my wife and I were in Cuba. Mm-hmm. We were staying at a very pleasant resort on Varadero. There was a wonderful beach. The other guests were Canadians and Danes and Italians.
Few Americans, right?
Very few Americans.
It's one of those really beautiful beach in North America.
I don't think there were any Americans. But we were having a great week. We went on a day-long bus trip that took us right across the spine of the island to the south coast and back, and we were having a lovely time. It was March 2020, and if you'll think back, March 2020 was a rather interesting moment in the pivots of the world.
Yeah.
In our hotel room, we had, for the first time in any visit to Cuba, we had a big television screen with CNN. And I regretted having a big television with CNN on it because every night, Wolf Blitzer would bring us worse and worse news from what was happening across the world. And a general kind of panic built among our fellow travelers. By the end of the week, everybody was kind of beside themselves with the urge to just get home. And so on the trip to the airport, aboard our bus filled with panic-stricken people, what I remember is the guide, a young guy who was taking tourism studies at the Cuban University, just crying his eyes out.
Crying, literally.
Literally crying. And he wailed, "Where am I ever going to get a job like this again?" And he was right, because in short order, it all collapsed.
Uh-huh.
The entire, if you'll remember back, that's, 4 years ago?
It must have been like a worldwide collapse, right?
It was.
Everybody went home.
The entire hospitality industry, restaurants, hotels, airlines, cruise lines, all shut down. And they shut down for what would turn out to be a substantial period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And that caused us to be able to realize the size of that whole enterprise, all those things added up together, airlines, cruise lines, hotels, restaurants. In some countries, they amounted to 10% of the economy.
Yeah.
And all of these people were out of work and everything was shut down. But at the same time, something extraordinary was happening on the other side of the equation, because with fewer planes in the skies, we suddenly realized the air was cleaner.
Yes, wasn't it India, in Delhi? They saw clear air for the first time in
Delhi. They could see across. They could see across the street. with fewer cruise ships, the oceans got calmer and cleaner. In a very short space of time, the whales and dolphins were happy. The people of Venice declared that their city was calm and quiet.
Oh, my God.
And so you had this extraordinary dichotomy of tensions, stark realizations about the size of that industry and that economy on the one side, and then on the other side, the costs, environmental, cultural,
hell.
And so that provoked me to kind of think, well, these tensions are worth a good hard look. And so I went ahead with this book.
Wow. What I noticed, by the way, I really appreciate in your writing, is you place yourself in almost every story. I mean, you really have been circulating at all the places where tourism is crucial to economies, or it's debated where to have it. Like you, I think you were in Jerusalem, right? At one point,
I've been in Jerusalem, yes.
And that's a very. On the one hand, it's good for tourism.
Not within the last year.
In the last year,
no, not
no, and. When I, for example, I also link you went to Dubrovnik. Put yourself in the problem. You are in a village, and you look out at the sea, and there's a ship as big as the village or bigger.
Yeah. Well, I love to travel. I've been lucky, in that like you, I've been a writer and a journalist, and it's taken me to many places. You and I met in. Nairobi, I think. In Arusha, Tanzania.
Arusha. Yeah. Arusha, Tanzania.
Yeah.
But you know more about, I remember also, yes, Nairobi. you went to parts of Nairobi that my work didn't take me there, and I'm just as happy that it didn't. But you, some of the rougher parts of Nairobi, because you were looking into the AIDS business.
Yeah. At that time, which is also about 20 years ago, I was working as a writer and filmmaker with some AIDS researchers. But I've traveled rarely as a tourist, mostly as a function of work, and not to get, high horse about that difference. But the difference is important, and you asked about the tourism becoming an industry earlier. About 25 years ago, in the mid-90s, I lived in Winnipeg, and I remember I went to a lecture at the art gallery given by sort of the leading public intellectual of the day, Susan Sontag.
Uh-huh. And she shows up in the book, by the way, for you two people want to know.
I refer to her,
there's
yes.
This nice discussion of Susan Sontag. Go ahead.
Well, I don't remember what the lecture was about, but I do remember that in the Q&A at the end of the lecture, somebody asked her what phenomenon did she see as being most influential on the future of how our world unfolds. This was like 1994, 1995. She said mass tourism.
Ah.
And for me, a light went on. I thought,
okay, there's a book.
I thought, yeah, she's right. And so yeah, I got busy. I did some research, and I produced a book called Tourists, How Our Fastest Growing Industry is Changing the World.
This is today's topic, How Our Fastest Growing Industry is Changing the World. It's a, what year was this
book? Well, that was 1996.
96. And so you've been on this story.
Well, what's interesting about it, it was published by Faber & Faber, and it had a little life. But in 2020 or 2022, when I started thinking about this again, I realized that everything I thought and wrote about in the 1990s, while it was prescient, which pleased me, it was also kind of quaint. Because tourism in the mid-1990s had barely been identified as an industry.
In the 90s?
In the 90s. Airlines and hotels were seen as industries. But across the whole, the massive capitalization that would later ensue had not nearly been organized. The cruise industry was just beginning to turn out those enormous ships that, you know, now they cost $1 billion and have
that's one of the staggering points that I read in your book.
Have 20
the size of those ships.
22 decks, you know, they're like towns.
And they compete for decks, right? One guy gets ahead two decks, the other one ups it by three.
Sure. But none of that was just starting to unfold. The all-inclusive resorts, which are such a big deal. Now we're only, you know, you had Club Med or Sandals,
I have a vague memory of that.
You don't
hear so much about it.
Well, they were just kind of exploring that whole phenomenon of let's give a package tour. The countries were just starting to calculate the place of tourism in their GDP statistics. Venice was not charging day fees to visitors. The word over-tourism had not yet been invented. The ease of self-organized travel had not yet been achieved. There was no Airbnb.
Ah,
we still use,
which is now part of our DNA.
Oh yeah, we still use travel agents and traveler's checks. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
We're talking 25, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
People had
their traveler's checks.
Of this has changed. The industry has quadrupled, according to the WTO, the World Tourism Organization, which is part of the UN, quadrupled in economic clout and doubled in the size, like, you know, 2 billion people get on airplanes every year to travel outside of their countries. And, you know, 25 years ago, we had travel agents and we had traveler's checks. Now, you and I could pull out our phones, or the people listening to us could pull out our phones.
Yes.
Within 15 minutes, we could arrange so that we could be in Singapore by this time tomorrow. We'd have a place to stay. We'd get there. This is all a phenomenon of the last 20 years, 20, 30 years.
Yeah, you speculated what Susan Sontag would have made of our phones, the way that, because she was very interested.
Well, she was talking about
photography.
Yeah.
But now we have these phones that would be a long essay. I guess the key word is narcissism.
Well, if you see a group of tourists walking down the street anywhere, we're taking pictures of ourselves.
Yes.
There's a big.
Here's me in the pyramids.
Well, the pyramids are sort of incidental.
Yeah.
There's been a big change too, from taking your single lens reflex camera and a 36 exposure roll of ektachrome and taking pictures while you're going through Paris and hoping that, you know, you'll find out 3 weeks later whether they turned out.
Whether it turned out.
And
why he had his eyes closed.
And having your phone and just snapping away, here I am here, here I am there, sharing that instantly with your friends back home, which in fact means that they kind of share your trip with you if they want. My wife was in Germany a few months ago, and you know, she'd send me pictures of her lunch.
Yeah, you
like
at this very time,
at the very moment she was eating it.
Yeah, and boarding a train, and the whole.
Yeah, so if you think about anticipating that 50 years ago, or 20, even 20 years ago, it's just boggling.
Which can be a little frightening of what might be coming, because it is so striking. By the way, I have to say, of course, we met in Arusha. If we had had that capacity to take a picture, say, of Ramsey Clark leaving court, or say, you know, just court situations, it really would have helped everybody understand what was going on there. It would have been a great benefit.
Oh, yeah. This,
because allegedly, after all, this was supposed to be, the ICTR was supposed to be something that we were all, you know, like it's like a public trial. So who's at the trial and who's, and they were still back in the 90s, which may as well have been 1900. But if we could have been producing pictures every day, we would have had something.
Well, these changes are not universally negative. They're just.
Yeah.
They're just dazzling.
Yeah.
And some of them are, some of them have negative repercussions.
Yes.
Certainly. But
well, of course, you are a jaundiced traveler. I mean, you have a view, you're watching things all the time, and you have a highly skeptical spirit. You say, oh, everybody's, because as you mentioned in the book, superlatives are used everywhere. This is fabulous. You're going to see this. It's going to be, but you're always sort of at the back of the tour group saying, how much are these guys paid? Did anybody around here get a tip? Does he get to keep them? You know, that kind of stuff. But at the other, well, you also put yourself, again, you were at the, you made yourself right at the crossroads. You were sitting somewhere, I think it was Croatia, Serbia, and you heard people laughing, and that's when you realized what the phone was, how.
That was, I think, probably around 2007.
Your eyes kind of opened. What was going on?
Well, I had, at that moment, it actually wasn't a phone. It was the digital camera, which I had a digital camera in 2007. But I'm a traditionalist. I saw it as a camera. So I took pictures. And
had to prepare.
And all of that. And then at the next table, this group who was having a hilarious time were using it as for fun. They were taking pictures of each other and then instantly showing them because that's what you and it just clicked with me at that moment that the digital age had transitioned us into this being not a camera but some version of a toy.
Yes.
If you wanted it that way. Within only a couple of years after that, the iPhone was available as not just a phone, but a camera. And then the selfie sticks. And you know, we were away to the races.
Yeah. By the way, and we're speaking to Larry Krotz. The title is Trapped by Tourism, Sustainability Questions for a World Fueled by Travelers. Larry Krotz, Trapped by Tourism. And you, of course, you had a book, you just mentioned it a while ago, Tourists, How Our Fastest Growing Industry is Changing the World. I guess we're probably going to be expecting some more books here because you've posed a bunch of questions.
But that one's 25 years ago and many, many changes
so
have happened.
That's when you were really on the cusp. You didn't know. You didn't know how big a cusp it was at the time. But another matter on this iPhones or phones, the way we use them, that is contributing to problems, right? Because you spoke to me previously about this matter of influencers. So someone goes, say, to a place in Indonesia, an island nobody ever saw, and there's a mountain view that nobody's, you know, most of the world have never seen, just the locals. They take a picture, and in a few days, people are booking to go and stand at the exact same place.
Yes.
Or hours.
Yeah.
And so what happens to the locals?
Yeah. I mean, it's always been sort of like that. I mean, travelers have always been motivated to seek out the special places. Sometimes it's the iconic places. Okay, we got to see the Eiffel Tower because we're told that we should, or the Colosseum in Rome, or so on. But we're also motivated to find the novel. Let's see if we can go where no one has gone before. And there's always been an industry built around that of guidebooks, of travel consultants, tour companies and tour guides. But it was a very slow moving kind of thing. But as you say, or as I said before, if you want.
That's a curse for the
well,
for,
yeah.
Well, it's a blessing.
It bubbles down. I want to talk about this a little bit because you talked about the locals, the people who are in anything. But to get to that first, the so-called influencer. I'm too old to have the current kind of online influencers, but they're a big deal.
Yeah.
For you know, many people in our culture. And they have, in many ways, replaced the guidebook. You know, you don't go to the bookstore, you buy Frommer's or
Mr. Frommer.
Or
Recently Passed.
Yes, or Lonely Planet. You just go online and they'll tell you where to go, what's the latest hot spot, how to get there, where to stay when you get there. You pull out your phone, and as you say, within 6 hours, you're on the plane if you want.
Yeah.
And because of our numbers, I mean, traveling used to be a very special thing that people saved up their money and went on their holiday.
One-off. We're going to go see
one the one-off. Or
the horrible expression, the bucket list people.
Well, yeah. Now, hopping on an airplane to go somewhere on the other side of the world whenever you have a few days off or a few extra dollars is pretty much embedded in our culture.
Yeah.
There's been an enormous explosion of numbers because of that. And then this quest to find the special places driven by, you know, this instantaneous communication the quote-unquote unspoiled beach is only good for about, you know, three days.
The formerly.
Yeah, and that happens everywhere. And some kind of awful things are riding on the tail of that. I've been corresponding a little bit by email with the Globe and Mail reporter Eric Regulay, who lives in Rome.
Mm-hmm.
And Eric has lived in Rome for quite a long time.
Does he hate tourists?
Well, he's written about what tourism has done to Central Rome. He hates it. He hates that aspect of it. The numbers of tourists and the impact that accompanies them, apartments being turned into Airbnbs, the restaurants and coffee shops catering not to the locals but to the visitors.
Prices.
The press of numbers. The people with our iPhones. The iconic places being turned into kind of Disneylands.
Oh my gosh! Yes, that's a
yeah, and. What do you do? The Romans, now, if you loiter on the Spanish steps, you're subject to a fine.
If you do what? I'm sorry?
Loiter on the Spanish steps.
Wow.
Now, loitering on the Spanish steps was what You did on the Spanish Steps up until a couple of years ago. Or coin throwing into the Trevi Fountain. That's also, all this stuff is restricted just because of the press of numbers and the pushback of locals who have had
enough.
Who
wish to have the life.
Yeah.
No, that it is one of the most disturbing things, and this is really close to home for you, is this having churches that are historic sites, particularly in Britain. You were there in a dual row. You made the tour of the church and went up the stairs and down and looked at this and had everything pointed out, et cetera, and then came back next day as a church member. You attended a church. It must have given you an ambivalent feeling.
Well, this was, I did this deliberately. My wife and I, Stephanie and I, took a drive.
Did you feel authentic? That's a word, by the way. It's very big in this book.
Well, let me.
Trapped by tourism, Larry Krotz. Go ahead.
Let me get to this. There's one of the chapters in the book is about the English cathedrals, of which there are like over 50 Church of England cathedrals and 25 or Catholic cathedrals, somewhere like that. All these incredible, enormous buildings all over the country. The tension, though, is they're very expensive.
Yike! Yeah.
To keep functioning. The congregations are shrinking. So how do you keep these things going? Well, you turn them into museums and charge admission.
Charging admission. There's a problem.
Well, is it? That's
I know,
the debate.
Yes.
Yeah.
You're working on the questions. I'm looking.
the tension, though, is at which point, at what point do things tip over? Does something stop being a church? And like the visit you're referring to, we were in Hereford, which is up in, it's in Herefordshire, but up in, on the Welsh border. An enormous cathedral in Hereford, 40 times as big as any other building in the town. And it's the repository of some extraordinary thing. The Mappa Mundi is housed in
Herford.
Can see it. And you pay to see it. You drop, at that time it was £12. I don't know what it is now. And that's legitimate. That's the museum aspect of it. And there were scads of people going in and paying their money to go see, various artifacts. And the building itself. Get a coffee, go to the gift shop and all this kind of thing. But the next morning, this was a Saturday, the next morning we returned to the same building and went in for free because we were going to church.
Worship it.
Yeah. Yes. But, we dropped a tenner into the collection plate.
A little extra, perhaps.
But the whole point is that this was the same building functioning in both directions as a place
of
worship.
It's teetering or something.
It's teetering. Yes. And that chapter was fun to write because in the interest of attracting, it's a different project to attract worshipers and to attract tourist visitors.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of the cathedrals in England have done ridiculous things
Please go on. It's a shock.
in order to attract the tourists. The cathedral at Chester has a 200,000-piece Lego set, which is a replica of the cathedral. And for the price of a pound, you can put one of these 200,000 pieces.
You're building inside the church, a Lego of the church.
Lego of the church. Another one in Rochester has installed, and this is still functioning, as I understand it, a mini golf in the nave.
What we call a miniature golf course.
Miniature golf course, a little
putting, inside the church.
Yes, a little putting thing where you putt over the. I
think a few prophets would be upset with it.
Well, that's what made it interesting because there were people turning, clergy and so on, turning themselves into pretzels to kind of justify this theologically. In Rochester, one of the curates explained that, putting the golf ball over the little bridges reminds us of the bridges that we have to cross in our personal and spiritual lives. But the one that took
I'm sure every 10-year-old gets it.
Yeah. Well, the one that took the cake is in Norwich. the Norwich Cathedral in Norfolk installed something called a helter-skelter. Now, if you're in England, you know what a helter-skelter is.
They know the book, unfortunately.
A physical...
The Manson Gang.
A physical helter-skelter is a kind of elevator you go up to a high point at which you step through a door, and then you can get on a circular slide.
And you slide down.
And
the rationalization, he said he saw Da Vinci or something?
Well, the main purpose was to attract paying visitors.
Yeah.
The justification was that, it took people up closer to the ceiling so they could see, the mosaics and so on that were...
See the ceiling.
In that one, there was so much scorn and pushback that the thing only lasted a couple of weeks, and then they took it down.
Some bishop sounded off on it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, but the poor – I started to say devil, didn't I? The poor fellows having to argue this, here you're using all your theological training and your – and commitment, et cetera, to arguing about whether or not you should have a miniature golf course in the church.
Yeah. But
I hate to laugh at people. I mean, that's not fair.
But the issue that it seeks to address is larger, and that is, how do you keep these things going? You got to put a new roof on the place, or there are all these numbers about how many hundred pounds it costs per minute to keep, Durham Cathedral functioning. And so this is where tourism and tourists intersect with other parts of our culture and our economies.
Mm-hmm.
So you see, maybe tourism is the answer. And tourism's a big – and everybody's into that. We're in Toronto – where we've heard nothing in the last 3 weeks about except the importance of Taylor Swift having her concerts here and what that means to the hospital.
Yes.
What kind of a shot in the arm to the hospitality
Absolutely.
Industry?
Absolutely. I was prepared to name part of the town after. That's okay by me. I'm tired of seeing Brock every time I turn a corner. I'd prefer Taylor Swift. By the way, again, we're talking to Larry Krotz, and the book is Trapped by Tourism. And Larry wrote an almost prophetic book called Tourist in the 90s. And, of course, the theme is our fastest growing industry is changing the world. And of course, you strike a balance. You're trying to show how big it's getting, how important it is. But you also, the word you introduce in one of your chapters is, when is it too much? And you're talking about churches, we're really at the too much point, so it seems. Speaking of another part of that on the too much business, I can tell from the writing you're not exactly enthused about cruise ships. And they go to islands, you would know them all, but of course they've had problems. The population is small. cruise ship pulls in, everybody unloads, they wander through in the town, and then they leave. But meanwhile, it's a total disruption for the, I have to call them the locals. And one of the solutions that they have now are working at, these cruise line outfits have bought islands. And so they will take you to their island to give you that sort of, oh, here's virgin territory. That didn't exactly satisfy anybody, right? It's now it's no longer a virgin island, and then you go back to loss of income at the original stopping point.
Yeah, it depends what you want. I mean, if you just want a day on the beach, then to go to the little Caribbean atoll that is owned by whichever cruise line.
Is recent, by the way.
Yeah, 10, this is recent. One of the problems for the whole crew, there are a number of players who need to be satisfied in the whole. There are four main players in tourism that need to be satisfied. One are the travelers ourselves. We want to have an experience that we feel we got our value and we enjoyed. Second is the industry that has to make money. Third are the governments that also see this as fitting into the economy and creating employment and creating taxes and so on. The fourth, and the one that gets satisfied the least, are the locals on whom the tourists descend. We tourists descend. I'm including myself in that group. With the cruise business, one of the problems, and it's still an ongoing problem, is that you live your life on the ship. You sleep on the ship. You have your dinner on the ship. If you pull into Venice, or you pull into, Dubrovnik or wherever, or one of the Caribbean ports, you unload, 3,000 people to rummage around for 6 hours on shore, and they might buy a spot of lunch or they might buy a trinket, but they're not going to buy a proper meal. They're not going to pay for a bed. Mm-hmm. They're just going to spend, a very small amount of money comparatively, because they're going to go back on board for their dinner and for their night. And so the locals get ticked off. They say,
I dare say.
Why am I putting up with this, which is no benefit to me?
Yes.
And that's the issue, the benefit to me. To continue with the cruise line thing, though, there was enough, it became enough of an annoyance, both for the cruise lines themselves didn't like the bad press they were getting, by dumping all these people off in Dominican Republic or Bahamas. And so they said, well, to heck with it, we won't go at all to these populated places. We'll just buy our own islands or create our own islands. And they got these unpopulated little atolls, and they set up a system where the ship will dock, the runabouts will come and unload people, and you'll get your beach day. Yeah. And maybe there'll be somebody there to sell you some trinkets and so on, but it's a hermetically sealed experience, because you are not going to meet any Bahamians or any whoever by doing that. But they feel
one third of the value of travel.
Well, they feel no, but some people don't care about. They're happy just to have their beach day, then go back on the ship, because the ship has all kinds
of things.
Maybe
they'll produce artificial locals.
Well,
the
ship has other functions. Some of these ships are casinos. Some of them are big theaters. They have, sometimes it's just, a lot of people, and it is a lot of people, want to get on and just ride around for a while and have nice meals and entertainment every night.
You point out something I never it was really remarkable, and actually it's a logical, follows logically on the sort of philosophy driving this, that there are places where you go aboard the cruise ship, but you don't go anywhere.
There are
You go out there and you're on the cruise ship.
Yeah, there are cruises to...
It seems like a smart idea. What the heck? On the water.
There are cruises to nowhere. And, you know... And
a ship of fools.
Well, maybe. Maybe it's just you get away from home and you ride around, you look out and you're looking at...
Good food, good service. But
that's a phenomenon.
A major thing is in your book, and by the way, and again, it's Trapped by Tourism, Larry Krotz, is, I mean, we got to address it. It's pollution and loss of wildlife, a number of whales that get run over by these, and or habitats that have been pretty secure now being taken apart. And what anybody would think of, dumping waste into the ocean, which is only has to be growing because we're talking about a larger and larger fleet of cruises. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, in fairness, it's something that they're addressing.
But who's they, by the way? You point out who's going to enforce?
Yeah,
a Liberian ship.
That is
Panamanian ship.
The two things that are supposedly being worked on are fuels that are used and control of waste. Okay.
Gray water
and plastics, all kinds of stuff that goes overboard. Food wastes. But for almost all of history, the seas were ungoverned places. Mm. You're out there. Nobody's going to hold you to account. You do what you like.
Yes.
And in many cases, there still aren't governments holding these ships to account because you can fly a flag of convenience. You're owned in Miami, but you're flying the Liberian flag or you're flying the Panamanian flag. And so if they don't put any restrictions on you, away you go. But public opinion, and I think the opinion of people who are cruise riders, is insisting on higher levels of responsibility, and some of that's happening. But at the same time, the numbers are so phenomenally, you know, the ships are bigger, the ships are more of them, the cruises are more frequent, so you got numbers working against attempts at responsibility, and who knows where those chips land in the end.
It's encouraging to hear somebody's trying to address it, but it's sort of like talking about the environment. Everybody's very concerned.
Yeah.
And they all give speeches. Oh, we're going to set a target.
The world tourism industry had to sign on to the Glasgow Accords when all the climate folks met, and they signed a list of, you know, goals and objectives.
Goals. And so. Yeah, you mentioned that these guys are smart. They got lawyers and they got PR men, and they say, "Hey, we're on this," you know. And then they make that into the appeal. Hey, we are green conscious, we are committed to the environment. Sail with us. And then you say, well, so you're committed. So what are you doing?
Well, we're
paying for it. We're looking into scrubbers. Yeah. I love the scrubbers point.
Yeah. Well, we're all hypocrites in some way on that topic. I remember going, it was 20 years ago, going into a hotel. The first time I saw the little sign in my hotel bathroom that said, if you want to save the environment, you know, only put your towel in the tub if it needs laundering.
you're helping save the environment.
Well,
and meanwhile, you're saving the hotel money.
Yeah, but the appeal was that somehow I could save the planet by using my towel twice.
You're the unguilty traveler.
It helped.
Yes. This is Larry Krotz. Can't say it enough. Trapped by Tourism. Trapped by Tourism, Larry Crotts, Sustainability Questions for a World Fueled by Travelers. I want to make sure I ask you, there's a great chapter in the book. We're discussing the Canadian situation and a thing called Indigenous Travel. I think it's actually an organization, ITO, yeah. Indigenous Travel. Oh, yeah. And because I have friends and relatives in Manitoulin, you devoted a lot of attention. I really appreciate that. And they are wrestling with the question, and I was very impressed with the story of the I don't know the name of the nation, where they're not going to accept the word tourist. Talk about them and how they're dealing with this situation.
Well, I spent some time on Manitoulin because it shows it as an example of. There's six First Nations on Manitoulin Island in Ontario, and all of them have recognized in one way or another that tourism is part of the ticket to self-sustaining.
Yeah, like Cuba,
community.
It would help.
Particularly
when you're in your situation.
The ideal is bring in guests and money and provide employment. And this is, Manitoulin is an example. This is happening all over, Indian nations in the United States and First Nations across Canada.
This is the best one I've read in terms of getting your hopes up.
And far afield, the Maasai in Tanzania and Kenya are trying to figure out how to make tourism work for them.
They cross that border.
The tension or the challenge or the issue has to do with sort of, I think, what they call cultural integrity. Mm-hmm. And that is, can we be ourselves or do we have to turn ourselves into something that our visitors imagine we ought to be?
Yes.
And so that's at best... The folks in Manitoulin are working hard at this, and so are the Maasai across on the other side of the Atlantic. The interaction with visiting tourists is a chance to provide education about who we are, who we were, where we've come from, what our struggles are, and all of this kind of thing. That's at best. At worst, you get swamped by the preconceptions of your guests who want you, and this is to take off your day outfit and put on your buckskins and
where's your headband?
So
I don't see any feathers.
It's an interesting challenge, and it's an interesting tension, and it's an interesting place. And tourism in Indigenous communities is a big deal. It's in numbers.
Well, you quoted one of the individuals representing this particular nation, and they said, we have a communal society, and we're not going to have an entrepreneurial model. Well, that's a magic word. They're going to be themselves. And you, if that's what you want to see, if you want to see them, that's who they are. And so you're going to have to do a little adjusting. This thing about being a traveler or a tourist and show me the stuff, you're going to have to do a little transforming of yourself, right?
Which
gives you the chance and perhaps appreciating Indigenous culture.
Which ideally is why we would travel anyway or historically have traveled, in order to meet people we don't already know and to learn something.
Yes.
So that's it at its best. At its worst, it's we travel only to see what is predicted and only to do what is safe and not to meet any real local people because they might infect us. And, so those are the two poles.
Well, you were there, What's your sense of, do you think that they're going to, they're sort of just initiating this, right? This is relatively new.
It's fairly new.
What do you think the prospects of that are?
Well, I think the prospects are.
By the way, they don't run around collecting money either.
Well, that's one of the issues is how to monetize.
Without spoiling the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah. How do we charge? What kind of entry fees do we? It's the same thing as the cathedrals. What kind of entry fees do we charge? What will the traffic bear? What will we offer to people? Wikwemekong on Manitoulin. One of the things they offer, and it's quite expensive. It's like several hundred bucks. You can spend a day, and I think this is kind of a clever one. You or your family, your visiting family, you can spend a day with a guide hunting and gathering for your supper.
Yeah, I like that one. I read about trout, and I said, I'm in for that. The taste of trout is
But very yes, special. Yes, how to balance all of this, how to make sure the local folks benefit rather than suffer, how to make the experience educational and interesting for the visitors, how to protect the environment and your cultural integrity while this is going on. Those are the challenges.
Again, this is Larry Krotz, and the book is Trapped by Tourism. Larry Krotz. I like the fact that it seemed a little off course, but that you discuss why do we travel, why do we want to be tourists at all? And then I find myself reading Kierkegaard and Anatomy of Melancholy sources, and which, you know, go into that issue. I was going to put to you I've always liked the observation by Pascal. He said, all of our problems stem from our inability to sit still in a room. Our restlessness is a problem. Go ahead.
Well, do you see restlessness as a problem or just as
I think he's right about command of yourself.
Or as the human condition.
Yeah, I think as an anecdote, I think it's a healthy thing to be a little skeptical about why we're doing this.
Yeah, yeah.
And would I be just as well off? If somebody says you can send a donkey to Rome and it won't come back a horse. But if they have a real curiosity. Obviously, you're a writer who works from curiosity.
Alain de Botton wrote about a guy in the 18th century who in a Frenchman who said, why should I go to the Netherlands when I can just go to the Louvre and I can see better, more idealized pictures of windmills in the Louvre than I can if I take all the trouble of packing all my stuff and going to the Netherlands. So that was his position. But we humans, and this is, you know, we're in the middle of so-called immigration crisis right now. We've always wanted to travel. We've always wanted to immigrate. We've always wanted to move. We've always wanted to go somewhere. We've always wanted to see what is on the other side of the next hill. Mm-hmm. And I don't think you shut that down.
Yeah. No, that phenomenon of going the extra mile, I did a lot of deer hunting, and my father was always determined we would go deeper into the mountains, into the forest than anybody else. If he saw footprints, keep walking. Mm-hmm. He didn't like and he was trying to get away from something. I mean, well, he wanted to be in that spot where the other guys didn't make it.
If you had been an influencer and had access to the internet via your phone in those days, you could have said, here's the place nobody has gone before.
Right.
You can all come here tomorrow.
Yeah, the last footprint.
The last footprint.
You do take that up, coming practically to the close, but you also say, and this I thought very important, is that we're leaving a larger and larger footprint. That's one of the problems. All these people are actually, they have more money, they're doing more things, so it's bigger and more worrying.
First of all, there are three times as many people on the face of the earth than there were when I was a kid.
Yeah.
We all...
That's probably our fault.
Yeah. We all, in general, have more money, more resources. My environmental footprint is 100 times bigger than my great-grandparents.
Yeah. Very sobering. Larry, it's been a pleasure talking to you. This is Larry Krotz, Trapped by Tourism. And he had a prophetic book called Tourists, How Our Fastest Growing Industry is Changing the World. You ought to get both books, but I'm really knocked out by it. So we want to thank Larry Krotz. This is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT, and we got a great show coming up.